All right. Good morning. Good morning. It is, what is today? Today is Monday, the 29th of June, 2026. And Pete, what's the number?
265. Crank it in, Robert. Crank it in, Ralph.
Crank
Crank
it
it
in,
in.
guys. Here we are. It's summertime in Northern Virginia. I'm sure it's summertime out in California. Also, we got a lot to talk about here. Start with travelogue. Pete, you've been to San Diego. Dean has been to New York City. I have been nowhere. I've been here in Northern Virginia. Tell us about Dean, Pete, San Diego.
Yeah, actually, it's amazing how sometimes a compromise trip turns out to be absolutely amazing. My son and I last summer had talked about going to New Mexico, and then the TSA things came up. And I said, man, I'm not so sure we want to get airplanes from the Bay Area, from Burbank, and all the things that are going on, and 6 hour backups. I said, let's figure out something different. I said, let's go to San Diego. And what a pleasant surprise and absolutely amazing. We said, boy, we're glad we didn't go to New Mexico. But there's a lot of really interesting things, and the highlights to me professionally was really exciting because we were on the USS Midway. And first of for six weeks of my life, when I was back when I was a midshipman, I was in an aircraft carrier. So I actually was an aircraft carrier at sea. So it meant something to say, yeah, I know what that's about. But a lot of the products that were on the Midway, I had actually been involved with some of the programs. So it was something like living your past. We got to see some products built by McDonnell Douglas, which was fascinating. Then there's a wonderful aerospace museum there in San Diego. And something right next door that we didn't think about doing, but it was right next door to the Aerospace Museum, Automotive Museum. And all these Formula One cars. These things go 200 miles an hour. It's thin sheet metal around the guy's driving them. Scared the hell out of you. But it was really fascinating. They had a collection of motorcycles too, which was fascinating to see some of these motorcycles built in the 20s and 30s. So well worth the effort. We went to the Hotel Del Coronado, which is a landmark, and it was built over 100 years ago. And all the elite, that's where they meet and greet back the Hollywood stars and all that back in the 1920s. Just fascinating. So really good, very enjoyable. And both my son and I said, man, that was great. So it was something totally unexpected.
Well, I hope you repeat it. It sounds terrific. It sounds great. It sounds like a lot of fun. San Diego is always a lot of fun. I like that. I like the town a lot. So, Dean, you were in New York City.
I was for a momentous 66 birthday with our 3-year-old grandson. He's not 66. That's unfortunately, it's the old man. But we had a great time. It was a food trip. We ate at what is supposed to be the best pizza restaurant in New York, which is very controversial because it's actually in Jersey City, and it's ranked as the number third pizza restaurant in the United States by somebody's ranking, and it was quite good. And we had lots of, New York foodie trips are fun. And then we also went to a ship themed event. We saw Titanic, the show. And if you haven't heard of this show, it's the story of Titanic, like in the movie, as if Celine Dion, who sang the song, was actually on the Titanic, and from her whacked out weird perspective, because the actress that plays Celine Dion does this big French accent and is crazy, and it's very, very, very funny. Jim Parsons from Big Bang Theory, the smart guy from Big Bang, he plays Rose's mother, and he's in drag the entire show. So it's one of these ridiculously whacked out funny shows. So we had a
Sounds
good
like
time.
a New York City show. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a typical New York City trip, but I will give a shout out to the Acela train from here to New York. What a pleasant way to travel. I mean, no security lines, nice big seats, nice cafe car, no issues with checking luggage. It's like I would do that every day. So it's not particularly cheaper than flying, but it is a much more pleasant travel.
My daughter took the trip down on the Acela too, and she had the same reaction. So really, really nice. All right. So Dean was in New York City. I didn't go anywhere. I've been staying here in Northern Virginia the whole time. But one thing I wanted to mention, because it is the day after field day, and I'm sure that both of you guys were out there doing your thing on field day. So, Pete, tell us about your field day. What did you do?
Field
So Pete's attitude has not changed over the years. He and I share an aversion to hot weather, humidity, and mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Dean, how about yourself? You're a member of the Vienna Wireless Society in high regard there. I am
Yeah,
too, but
former president of the
former
Vienna Wireless
president,
Society.
you got to be there.
But now that I'm not the president of the Vienna Wireless Society, I don't feel compelled to be at all the events, and I was not there yesterday. I did a little bit of radio yesterday, but it had nothing to do with field day. It was the whisper transmitter work, which we're going to talk about a little bit later.
All right, yeah, well, field day. I mean, I wish everybody who had a field day, it seems like a contest. I did listen to 20 meters a little bit, and there was a lot of 5-9 Ohio, 5-9 Ohio, 5-9 Ohio, that kind of stuff. And that's
Oh,
just
well, ARL famously says it's not a contest, but it has all the markings of a contest. They keep score, you get points, you get published, you get to cheer when you have the most points.
But
So
I don't think it was on 17 meters, which is really, really good. But if it's not a contest, why wasn't it on 17 meters? I don't know. Who knows? It's a good point. Anyway, one other thing here at the beginning of the show, one thing I came across was the importance of taking a break. We've been over the years been putting out this idea that if you get stuck on a construction project or a theory project, the best thing to do is not to give up, not to strip all the parts off of the board, as Dean and I have in our nightmares done, but instead to take the thing and put it away for a while and go take a walk with the dog or go to the beach or take a walk in the woods or watch a movie or something and come back to it later. And a lot of people just act like this is kind of crazy talk. What are we talking about? But then I was listening to a podcast. And it's a podcast. It's a very popular podcast with Shyam Siddhartha, and it's called the Hidden Brain Podcast. And they did a whole episode on the importance of taking a break, and I have a link on it. And there is apparently some real kind of social science backup for our notion that it's useful to take a break. It causes your unconscious brain to focus on the problem, even when you're not thinking about it. Which is sort it sort of matches with our experience with this thing. When you're not thinking about it, when you put it away, all of a sudden, you'll be in the shower or you'll be walking the dog or something, and you'll suddenly think, yes, R16 should be 10K, not 100 ohms. Boom. And that's it. And it comes to you and you fix it. So check this out. And anybody who's interested in this kind of stuff, take a look at the Hidden Brain podcast. I've got a link up on the Solder Smoke blog page. You could find out what I'm talking about there.
Sometimes just going to bed, and then you wake up in the morning and it's Eureka, I have found it.
And apparently this is a pretty common phenomenon among people who were involved in real serious scientific research over the years. They're working on something and they just get stuck and they can't do it. And instead of they end up taking a break or walking away from it a little bit, and then boom, it comes to them. This Eureka moment. So, yeah, there's something to it. There's something else that I've been looking at. The 5 Meter Liberation Army, the FMLA. There was a series of articles written by Michael Hopkins, and Michael was a very talented guy. He's a silent key now, but he wrote the FMLA series, and it's farcical. It's fantasy that this guy, Frank Jones, who Pete reminded me of, Frank Jones comes back and he wants to retake 5 meters, which used to be a ham band when Frank was producing a lot. I have the book here. I have this book. Look, 5 meter radio telephony right there, 25 cents, design, construction, and operation. And so Frank designed all these books about 5 meters. And then when television came along, they took the 5 meter band away and it became Channel 2. And so the whole idea behind Hopkins' stories is that Frank comes back and he lives and is around us. He drives the same car and He has the same clothes from the late 1930s, 1940s, and his objective is to organize people and to take back 5 meters. But the underlying thing is that there's a whole lot of commentary in these stories about homebrew radio and about Frank Jones's dedication to homebrew radio. So it begins with the narrator, Michael Hopkins, contacting Frank on 20 meter CW or 40 meter CW, I think. And he Hopkins kind of stupidly goes ahead and describes his commercial equipment. This story will give you a flavor of what the FMLA book is like. And Frank comes back and he says, "Fine business on the commercial gear. Have you ever thought about amateur radio? Question mark." And
What a
it's
bird.
there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that there. And so I really enjoyed it. And I recommend it. But it also makes me think that even though Hopkins has been gone for many years now, this is an opportunity. We could just start up again. Frank could come back again. And we could combine the 5 meter Liberation Army with the CBLA, the Color Burst Liberation Army, which was, of course, modeled after Frank's efforts. So I hope that there are some talented fiction writers out there who can sort of submit chapters to the lexicon, to the body of work developed by Michael Hopkins way back when, and we could then have a continuation of the FMLA series. That's all there. So anyway, I encourage anybody to read this thing. But I one thing other thing came up. We've been talking a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, and I know Dean has been involved in this a lot. Dean knows a lot more about it than I do, and so I occasionally kibitz. And there's a group. There's a couple guys in Australia who are involved in this, but one of the things we were talking about here was how a while back with this Google product called Notebook LLM, we just sent them the URL and had them develop a podcast about solder smoke. And it sounded pretty good. And I joked at the time, I said, the next stage is that they're going to come up with fake voices. And you're going to be able to have the fake voices. And then a little bit beyond that, you're going to have fake videos. Anyway, Peter Marks down there, VK3TPM in Melbourne, went ahead and created an AI Pete Giuliano. And I mean, I think this is fantastic. This opens up all kinds of possibilities. We could have Pete talking bad about the SI-5351 VFO, singing the praises of LC VFOs, which are compressing the frequency tuning dial down to one tiny little millimeter. But anyway, I have on my phone here the AI Pete Giuliano. Now, Dean and I both listened to this, and we agreed that the real Pete Giuliano is a lot better than the AI Pete Giuliano.
I hope so.
I hope so. You've got humor. The elements of humor in there. They've got the voice down, but they don't have the humor. So let's just play a little bit of it here. Hold on. It's calling it up. Hold on. Oh man, I hope it works.
What's your final amplifier device? Bipolar transistor, MOSFET, a tube, and are we talking HF, VHF? Because the fix depends heavily on what you're driving that final with. But here's the classic checklist I'd work through. Lead dress is everything. If your input and output leads are running parallel or close together, you've built yourself a feedback network. Separate them. RF doesn't care about your tidy wiring. It'll find a path back. Ferrite bead on the base or gate lead. A small ferrite bead right at the transistor lead, not 6 inches away, right at the device, is often a miracle cure. I'm talking a small suppressor bead slipped right over the leg before you solder it down. Base or gate stopper resistor. A
Man,
small
it sounds like
resistor.
Pete. It sounds pretty good. We're getting there. What do you think? Tell me.
Bill, in AI and in persona generation, there's this concept of what they call the uncanny valley. And that's the place where the AI gets close to human, but not quite human. and you listen to it and you feel just a little uncomfortable because you know there's something not right. Pete was on his Xanax that day, I guess. I don't know. But it's just like it's like the early versions of AI image generation of people. You look at them and say, well, it kind of looks like somebody, but it just the eyes are a little too wide or whatever. So they call that the uncanny valley. And I think that's where we are with this stuff, at least at the dilettante level that we're all at, where you just use the tool that somebody threw out on the internet.
Well, also, I think that our position in the uncanny valley is driven by the fact that we know what the real Pete sounds like a lot. So,
Correct.
what do you think, Pete?
It just the voice sounds like me, but the phrasing is a little bit different. That's the difference, is the phrasing. Is that what you hear, Dee?
Yeah, there's no the intonation is off. It doesn't have the you accent words. You have an excited way of talking. That recording was very flat, and it was just like it was reading from a textbook. And it was like, that's where I get this kind of, ooh, it's not quite Pete.
It was very preachy too, and usually
Yes.
you'd be telling people how to avoid the famous Barkhausen criteria, which you've told us about, but you do it in a humorous way. The Gesinntes have to be far from the Gesautes and all that kind of stuff, and that makes it much more palatable for the amateur builder. This reads it's a little bit too prescriptive. It's a little bit too preachy. You must do this. You must do that. If not, you're creating a signal path. So I agree. We're getting there. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to share the AI Pete.
I would never say the SI-5351 is subservient to an analog vehicle. I would never say that.
I know, but you will be saying it soon, so stand by.
I
And then
think I think he took it from one of your blog posts, Pete.
all right, well, and thank you to Peter Marks, VK3 TPM, for providing us with the first listen to AI Pete. It's probably gone light years ahead of that by now. So we're probably ready for the full blown AI Pete.
I
Well,
have
it.
a. I
Go
was going
ahead,
to
Pete.
share a little AI story with you. The last blog post that I made, I highlighted that Toto was the bomb, and I went and asked them to generate a good-looking blonde that had Ukrainian roots. And there's a picture of me with this blonde. Someone writes me, says, "What's her name?"
There you go. Yeah, he's probably a
Contact
ham
reference.
looking at a worker on 20 meters.
So there's a kind of famous story loosely attributed to Carl Sagan, but probably just apocryphal, and it's about why we have no evidence of aliens having ever visited, because when they showed up, they took a look and they said, "No signs of intelligent life here."
Boom, back they went. All right, talking about signs of intelligent life, Dean, you have been involved in a kind of a follow-up with the whisper with the VWS Makers Group, and you've had some whisper success. I've got a
I
picture of the rig up on the blog page with a picture of your map. Tell us about it. There it is.
so I have the actual Whisper rig here if you're on the YouTube channel. And for everybody's reminder, this was published in the April QST magazine, actually. So we took a page from QST. Bob Fontana, call sign escapes me at the moment, designed the rig and wrote the article. And he actually lives right here in Potomac, Maryland, about a stone's throw from where Bill and I live. It consists of an SI-5351, which makes all those analog VFOs subservient or something. What was the quote? And it has a little microcontroller, an ESP8266 microcontroller, and a filter. That's it, and that's the transmitter. And it puts out about 15 milliwatts. And then I designed a homebrew amplifier, a little two-stage amplifier that has a 2N2222A and a 2N3866 transistor. So that takes it up to about about 250 milliwatts. And with that, I have been able to make contacts all around the world. And you'll see on the blog the Whisper map. I am heard. I won't call them contacts everywhere. So, New Zealand and Australia and South Africa and all over Europe and Sweden and yeah, so it's fun. I took the code that Bob provided and made some modifications to it. Current Vienna Wireless president Don KM4UDX and the master of all automated digital stuff said, "Well, why don't you make it more than just one band? Why don't you make it hop band so that it skips between all the bands?" And so I did that. So it hops bands, and so you just plug it in and let it go. And it rotates through the HF bands, and so I've got even though my antenna is a 80 meter off-center fed dipole, which shouldn't be resonant on 30 and 15 and all that, I'm being heard on all the bands from 80 to 10 all over the world. So it's been cool, and we had about 32. I made 32 packets up. I loosely call them kits. Sorry, but they're kits. But we had 32 of them manufactured by our built by our club members. A fair number of them who had never built anything at all before, never soldered, never done anything before. So it was a good starter project for people who want to kind of get a flavor for what it is that we do. And then I'm going to give them the real homebrew project is we're going to build the amplifier. And I still haven't decided if I'm going to do it, our traditional Manhattan style and pair it up with this beautiful Chinese printed PCB, or if I'm going to make my own PCB and do that. I'm kind of interested in doing the PCB only because I've never done that before, and it might be fun to do that once. And if I'm going to do 32 of them, it might be a little easier for the club. But we will, what we do in our makers group, whenever we take on a project like this, is we put out the schematic and we spend a meeting or two and we walk through every component on the board so that everybody understands what every resistor, every transistor, every pot is there for and why it's there and why it's at the value it's at. So we spend some time so people get an understanding of these circuits. So that's the report on the Whisper project. But it's been really successful. I've been really happy with what we've done.
I think it's really great too. I mean, it's a good project. As much as I kind of kid around about the SI5351 and code, it's a great way to see the kind of the melding of hardware and software in this rig. I mean, the fact that you have to build a filter, the fact that you're going to homebrew an amplifier, all that stuff is very, very much focused on hardware. But once you get into the SI5351 and the need to have code and to modify the code and to make it skip bands, all that stuff is in the software realm. So it's a really nice kind of mixture of the technologies.
So, in order to get the SI5351 stable at the higher frequencies, we actually pulled the crystal off the chip, off the board, and replaced it with a TCXO. And so there's a little more to it than just kind of plugging and placing, because you got to actually modify the board of the SI53. You got to cut a trace, and you got to do a little jumper. So we had some fun doing that, and we actually, got to do some debugging, because if the TCXO isn't making good contact with the SI5351 chip, you will not get oscillation. And so, all right, trace the signal. Where does it get? Are we getting a signal out? Is there a cold solder joint on the resistor? Let's look at the schematic and follow the signal. So we even got to do some debugging with that too. So it's not purely plug and play. It's a little bit of a intermediate.
Excellent, excellent stuff. Pete, what do you think?
Terrific, terrific. You've not to pass over too quickly. He's not running a lot of power, and he's being heard in Australia. So,
Correct.
which I think is significant.
Yeah, well, it also tells you that the whining about the bands not being open is just whining. I mean, signals can get through. You have to be a little persistent. And yes, I know It's a weak signal mode, and I know it's built for, 2 minute, it takes 2 minutes to make one of those connections, but you're still getting signals all around the world, and you can do it if you're persistent. And earlier on, when I first built your rig, Pete, the simple SSB, I was making contacts all over the world on 5 watts without trying too hard in what they said was a terrible part of the solar cycle, right? So you can make contacts. You got to get out there and you got to spend some time and do it. And Bill's found out if you get up really early in the morning, you can talk to Rarotonga every day. So
Rarotonga. I've worked all Rarotonga. I've got the worked all Rarotonga award.
I got one other report from the bench, and that is when Farhan came out with the SPIDEX product a few years ago, complicated, circuit board, but it took all of the processing in SDR and put it on a Raspberry Pi. I took it on myself to build a homebrew version of it. And actually, if you're looking on the screen, it's right behind me here. It's still on the plywood. About a year and a half later, I got to that point where I don't know how to package this thing up because it was a sprawl, and how do I? And I didn't want to build a second one, and so it kind of sat for I hadn't used it in a year, and I fired it up the other day. I downloaded the latest version of the SPIDEX software. There's a group not Farhan that is maintaining and enhancing the software. So, Bill, I got to come over and update yours because I think you'll like it when you see what the new software can
I
do.
got two of them sitting right up there. You can see them up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
But I made my first contact with the Dominican Republic, Bill, your old radio club, 100th anniversary. So that was,
Radio
and
Club Dominicano, my old club. That's great. That's terrific.
they're special event stations. So I thought that was a kind of an appropriate kind of bookend to my journey. Now, in terms of putting it on the shelf and thinking about it for a while, I think I now know how to package that thing up a year later. So I'm going to start on that next. That'll be probably my next project because I actually like it's actually a fun radio to use, and I take some pleasure in the fact that I have one of the only homebrew SPIDEXs on the planet. Maybe the only one. I don't know. There might be one or two others,
I was about to say the same thing.
but.
I think there's probably you might be the only one or one of very, very few others.
Yeah.
If anybody, let's use the podcast here. If anybody else has homebrewed an SBIDEX, please let us know.
I know there's one or two guys that have done similar things that post on the BitX 20 blog, but I don't know of it's got to be less than the fingers on one hand.
Yeah, it's true. All right. Well, thanks very much, Dean. Pete, one thing you didn't mention about San Diego was your visit to the surplus store in San Diego.
Oh yeah, Murphy Surplus. What a place. Yeah, the West Coast surplus stores are a thing of the past. There's only two that I know of, and one is in Burbank, that's Apex, and the other one is Murphy Surplus. And there's a distinct difference between the two. The one Apex, actually their primary business is supplying hardware to the movies. And you see consoles and things like that. I saw that in a movie, and it came from Apex. This is where they make most of their money. Disorganized, you can never find anything. You go to Murphy's, and he's actually got everything well identified on the shelf. And it's one of these things that are there's nothing priced. So I went in and I got a really heavy duty heat sink that I needed for a three terminal regulator, big heavy duty three terminal regulator, and two coils. And he looks at me and he says, "How about $2?" I said, "How about a deal?" It was one of those kinds of places. But he had a couple of Collins receivers in there. And I says, "Yeah," I says, I "they're 75A3s." I says, "You got two nice Collins." He says, "I can't get rid of them." He says, "Make me an offer. Make me an offer." So he says, "I'll take $200." I said, "Nah, I'm not gonna do that." But I mean, this is that kind of a place. You don't see that anymore. So many of these places, everything is priced, and there's no. This guy just whatever he's feeling, and it was really a trip back at that. Had a whole rack full of tubes, And you look at that, if you're building anything with tubes, a lot of them are stuff like 6146s, 2E26s, 6L6s, all stuff that we'd use in ham rigs. Now, there's nobody building, or very few people building ham rigs with tubes these days. So I guess they don't move too much is the thing. But Murphy Surplus, it's a hoot just to go there and visit. Maybe you don't buy anything, but he's got a lot of stuff that you can, if you've been in this hobby a while, you can put your hands on it and say, yeah, I know what that is.
Pete, you mentioned the fact that nobody's home brewing tube type gear, but you are, Grayson is, and this brings us to your revival of Frank Jones. We talked about Frank earlier. Frank Jones is last ditcher, and your construction technique really struck me as something that Frank Jones would really, really appreciate because you got the slats. He built everything on a wooden base. And part of the reason I discovered from reading the FMLA stories was that one of the reasons that he did this was because he was using AC/DC supplies, no transformer. So it was better for him to have it on a wooden base. Look, Pete's holding it up right now. So
Lift it up a little bit more. There you go.
this is the last ditcher. And he's got a couple of slats. Flip it over. Let's take a look at the underneath. See, this is what I like. He's got two slats. And Pete has got some PC boards, some copper clad boards, not PC boards, but copper clad boards between the two slits. And that allowed him to build all this stuff on basically a wooden box. And it's really, I think, really beautiful. I think Frank Jones would really appreciate and approve of the construction techniques. And I just think it's really amazing.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight one little thing in here, and that's this. You can hardly see it, this little device here. And the way this is, the last ditch was designed is from August 1947 QST. August 1947 QST. And it's intended to be operated from batteries. So you have the filament is 2 volts, and the plate is 135. And of course, you could buy 135 volt batteries literally anywhere in 1947, but they key the negative lead. So if you put your hands across the key terminal and you touch something, you're completing the circuit. So you got 135 volts.
As you
Well,
did, I'm sure you did many times as a young
yeah.
fellow. Yes.
So I wanted something to key the negative lead without me in low voltage keying, and so I was. Went to AI and I got some circuits that were absolutely awful and didn't work well at all. But then I said, well, let me try, and I designed something, and I needed a relay. I needed like a 6 volt relay, and so I went to Amazon, and I didn't find a 6 volt relay. I found a relay module, and you buy four of them for $7. And so I said, if the whole thing is there, and I couldn't believe it how well this worked. It needs 5 volts, and it has keying, which is kind of interesting. Have a low voltage keying or high voltage keying. It has a little jumper in the board. Low voltage anywhere between 0 and 4 volts, and then the high voltage is 4 to 12. So you could actually trigger this from an Arduino or an ESP32. I mean, you could key that thing and command it. So, and then I found out Todd K7TFC, he bought modules similar to this, and he keys the taps on a coil for an antenna tuner, and he can control it from an Arduino. Say, okay, I want to go to 20 meters. He clicks 20 meters, and everything works. So, but $1.75 for the whole module, and which I find fascinating. But anyway, this works. It puts out about a little less than a half a watt. It's got a 1J6GT in it. And it needs 2 volts, 2 volts at about a quarter of an amp. So it's pretty simple. But it's amazing because most of this stuff, there's only one thing that I bought, and that's essentially the wood I found in my junk box. I mean, just the
That's it.
stuff that I've had floated around for a long, long time, and I have records from the reverse speaker network. This thing works the western half of the United States, less than a half watt.
And have you had any contacts with it? Any two-way contacts? The
No, just
RBN's
test.
enough.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm just testing it to see. So I want to do that. And actually, I dug out my Arc 5, my 40 meter Arc 5. So I'm thinking about put a little station together with a 40-meter arc five and the last ditcher.
All right, excellent.
And then
And
there's one other one that I put together. This is steampunk. This is,
steampunk. I watched the last video. You got it in the background behind you.
this steampunk. This tube is a 955 acorn tube, 955 acorn tube. And this thing puts out about 140 milliwatts, and I was heard at the station at Stanford, which is almost 300 miles from me here, on 40 meters yesterday. So everything I found in the junk box.
I really like, Pete, how you in the video that you did about the steampunk rig, you were singing the praises of a little bit of chirp and a little bit of warble in the signal. And yes, I know what you mean. It's so rare when you hear a signal like that on the radio, you think, oh my God, somebody else has built a rig. I'm going to talk to them. Yes.
Well, the thing is, going back to the Jones, I have noticed because it's a push-pull oscillator, I do not hear any chirp or warble. I mean, I got samples on the ear, and there's a whole series of videos at the N6QW YouTube channel. You can see the last ditcher, you see this. Something about that Jones in the push-pull, the signal is T9. I mean, it's noticeably different, and the components are just a few components in there. That's the other thing, is not a ton of hardware in there, which you think about the time this is built in the 30s and the 40s, people didn't have money. It was the Depression, and they scrounged everything, and yet with few components they built these rigs. And the other thing, people turn up their nose, say, "Well, that rig's only 5 watts," or that's what. I'm 140 milliwatts, and it's being heard 300 miles away. So, I mean, what an opportunity to make some contacts on a little low power. Your ET2, what was it, 100 milliwatts?
100 milliwatts. I have it sitting over there right now. Yeah, it's still looking
Yeah.
at me. Yeah, I'm not gonna use it again, I don't think, but it's possible. That's using two different FETs. I it was.
12 milliwatts
There you go.
Yeah.
On my whisper. Right. Oh, and Pete, I love the fact that you got technology spanning 75 years in the
There you go. There you
And
go.
I really love it that all of us are kind of embracing a technology that is QRP, low power. I mean, the guys over in the GQRP Club and Sprat, they will really appreciate this. And I think it is
I don't
a
know,
record.
Bill. We might even get another award. Who knows?
Well, Pete's got an article in Sprat. I haven't seen
He
it yet. It
does.
hasn't reached my mailbox yet. But
Oh, get in
Dean
here.
has
I
it.
got it. Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I it's about the Jones rig. Yeah. All right. Pete, but this has launched you into a whole series about low power CW tube type rigs, correct?
Right. Actually, the YouTube channel's got the 6A6 down now. It's got a 53 in it. That's the Jones. That's the article. It was originally with a 6A6. It's got a 53 in there. I've got one with a 6AQ5, one with a 5763, a 955, and a couple of solid state rigs, and they're all low power.
It's really great. And I think it's a tremendous opportunity. One of the great things about CW is that it's pretty easy to build a simple rig and get it on the air. You don't have to hold, there's not a whole lot of futzing around and problems that come up. Certainly when you're trying to do an SSB rig, there's a lot of headaches there. With a CW rig, it's much more straightforward. It's not easy, but it's more straightforward. So I think
So
it's terrific.
I notice with a lot of CW projects, you'll see the circuit, but the power supply is not on there. It just shows up as like coming in out of the ether. So what are you using for power, Pete?
Well, first of $30, you can buy a power supply that'll run a lot of these low power rigs like the 6AQ5, the 5763. Amazon's got this supply, 300 volts at 300 mils, 6.3 volts at 5 amps, $30. So, I mean, it's pretty simple. Now, for the last ditcher, I actually built the supply, and actually had to build two supplies, one for the 135 volts. That's pretty simple to do. And in the video of the last ditcher, I included in the actually the 6A6, I include the schematics so you can see them. And then to get the low voltage, I used an LM317. So ran 6, 8 volts DC in there, and comes out at 2 volts at a quarter of an amp. So you can build them or you can buy the ones. And as a matter of fact, Grayson's rig that he sells uses one of the similar supply out of Amazon. So you can get, now, if you build one, a linear supply, you'd probably be looking over $100, but it's a switcher. And when I first plugged it in, there's something unique to the circuitry. When I first plugged it in, I didn't get anything out of it. I mean, it just sat there. Then after a while, it came on. And they do that because they have a big electrolytic capacitor. So when you turn it on, if you had that full amount there, it would short things out. So they have like a step start in there. They start out slow and then they build it up and then you get the full voltage. So I mean, it's got some nice features and it's small. It's about that big. So, about that size.
The other
So when
trick that
I
I've been hearing in terms of the power supply that I see some guys using sometimes is that a lot of us have an HP 23 power supply for the old Heathkit rigs here. And you could use that. You just work out the right kind of plug and plug it in. You could use that on a tube type rig.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I
As a
when
matter of
I when
fact,
I when I rebuilt the Hallicrafters worldwide, that was an old battery set. And of course, you can't get these big 90 volt batteries anymore. But I just built one with 10 9 volt batteries, and then I used another 9 volt battery for the low voltage. So you can, there's lots of ways to get there, but oftentimes that is a stumbling block for it was for me when I would see some of these designs. Like, well, they're assuming I got knowledge or some or gear that I don't have, and then I stop.
well, I always tell the story about when the guys gave me the HW32A for my first phone rig, and they handed it to me in the radio club. And I remember thinking, it seems kind of light. And then I looked around the back and I said, where do you plug this thing in? And they looked at me like, well, you got to build a power supply, of course. This was probably 1973, 1974. And this was treated as sort of a trivial project. And I said, well, where do I get the parts? They looked at me like, well, dummy, go find an old TV on the street corner. Pull out the transformer, pull out the rectifier tubes, pull out the caps, and you're good. Somehow I survived, and here we are. Anyway, Pete, thanks very much for that. I had on the notes here schematics and Copilot, but I think that's been resolved, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just don't use it.
All right. This brings us to the shameless commerce division. First, Pete mentioned something that I had forgot to put in the notes. We gotta put in a plug for mostly DIY RF. Our friend Todd, K7TFC, up there in the Silicon Forest of Portland, Oregon. Anyway, if you need a kit, if you need parts, take a look at the mostly DIY RF site. There's a link to it on the Solder Smoke blog page. It's on the right-hand side. Scroll down a bit. You'll see it. Great source, great kits, great parts, great stuff. And it's all designed mostly DIY RF for the home brewer. So check that out. The other thing I'd like to point out is if one way to support the podcast and support our efforts here is to become a patron. And the best way to do this is through Patreon. A number of people have done this, and it's really very, very helpful. It's an easy way to do it. It's an easy way to support the podcast. So I would encourage everybody to check out our Patreon page. I occasionally, post stuff there that I think will be of special interest to the patrons, and I'll continue to do that, but definitely check it out. Another thing that's come up recently, we've been thinking about this a little bit, and it used to be that every time we did a blog post or we did a new podcast, Google would send out an email to our mailing list. And this would alert people to the fact that, hey, there's something new on the blog, there's something new on the podcast. And that all just disappeared. Google stopped doing that. But there's no reason we can't do it. However, one of the problems is keeping the email list updated. So I will ask you, if you are interested in receiving an updated email every time or every week that we update the blog or do a new podcast, send me an email and I'll put you on the list. And the email to use is my regular old email, BillMara@gmail.com. BillMara@gmail.com. Send me an email with the email that you'd like to receive the alert on, and we'll get back to you and we'll let you know. And this might kind of make people reconnect with the podcast and with the blog. And also, one thing I would ask people to do is that when we do, especially on the podcast, but especially on the blog post, comment on it. There's a whole space down below for comments. And I really like to get comments on those things. And the number of comments has trailed off, I think, recently. I don't really know why, but the comments, even if you just say, I like it, or I read it, or I saw it, something like that, it's all appreciated. And it dispels us, it dispels the notion that we're sort of podcasting into the void or blogging into the void, that there is somebody out there listening. So please, comments let us know that we're not speaking into the Google void, the void
And
created by Google.
engagement drives the algorithm, right? So the more people click on things, the more likely it is that other people with similar interests are going to find. Same thing with YouTube.
Yeah.
Even if you don't comment, hit that like button, and that helps promote viewers and get it out there. We know that our audience is small, and as Bill has said before, we're never going to be Ariana Grande or Beyonce, but in the ham radio world, big fish, little pool, who knows?
Internet micro celebrities. That's who we are. Internet micro celebrities. Right, Pete?
Right.
Okay, and we're happy with that. All right. This brings me to my
Hey,
portion.
Bill.
Yeah.
GQRP Club. Sprat. Plug for those guys. And if you had Sprat, you could read the article about the Jones Oscillator.
And if
But
you're
you
not
need to.
getting Sprat, you're
You're wrong!
just wrong. Hey, listen, I want to make note of the fact, and I've got it on the headline of this podcast, on the blog. My new AI produced QSL card, Paul Taylor, VK3HN, sent me one, and it alerted me to the fact and reminded me of the fact that you could use AI to produce a QSL card, which is a great old ham radio tradition. And you could just tell it in plain language what you want on the card. Well, I want a picture of myself. I want some rigs in wooden boxes. I want Guapo the dog. I want the EB63A amplifier. And then I said, and I also want some books on the shelf. One should be Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. The other should be Experimental Methods in RF Design. The third should be the bound copy of Sprat magazine. That's on there. And then I said separately, on top of one of the rigs, maybe on top of the amplifier, I want something with Hayward written along the side. Boom, they did it. And I've got it on there. So you could see it. Now they even asked for a picture of me so that they could make the drawing look sort of like me. I don't think it looks that much like me. But anyway, it's there. So that's the kind of thing we could do. But I think you're right. If you're not subscribing to Sprat, you're just wrong, and support the GQRP
And a
Club.
subscription to Sprat also gets you membership in the GQRP Club all the way from England. And for the massive cost of $28 a year, you become a member of the GQRP Club, and you get that magazine in the article. It's
Four
amazing.
times a year. Yeah.
More times.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Comes
Good
in
stuff.
the mail.
It's
And they're
great.
nice people too.
They
So.
are. They're all really nice. I like them a lot. All right, so one thing I wanted to mention, this gets us back to the Drake 2B, because we talk a lot about the Drake 2B, and we'll talk about it more in a minute. But things were kind of slow here, and I was listening to 17 meter sideband on my homebrew single sideband dual band 1712 transceiver, and then I said, wait a second, I wonder how the same signal sounds on the Drake 2B, right? So, because I have a little switch here and I could just switch over real quick. So, I tuned in the same signal on the 2B and I was switching back and forth between the homebrew rig and the 2B, same antenna. And you know what? The Drake 2B sounded better. And I was trying to put my finger on it, what it was. And I started to realize that maybe the amount of gain in the homebrew rig was not quite up to snuff, not quite up to the level that the Drake 2B was on. So, for example, take a listen to the band noise. We always talk about how if you can hear the band noise, you've sort of reached the limit of sensitivity for that rig. It doesn't make any sense to go beyond that. But I noticed that with the homebrew rig, I could hear the band noise, but just barely. I mean, when I threw the switch from the antenna to off, I could hear it, but just barely. Whereas on the Drake 2B, it was really noticeable. So this led me to believe that probably in the RF amplifier, in the homebrew rig, I probably don't have enough gain. And I checked and I looked at the little board that I had on in there that came from Todd, by the way, K7TFC. And I noticed that there's three resistors that set the gain on the TIA amp. And I had it set for about 10 dB of gain. And I said, wait a second, if I just change the three resistors, I can add an additional, I take it up to about 20 dB of gain. And I tried that and it worked really well. So now when I throw the switch, I hear a similar level of band noise that I hear on the Drake 2B. So it just showed you the ease with which you can increase the gain on a TIA amp. Now, it wasn't easy. I had to get those three little resistors out, put them back in. It was kind of hairy there for a minute, but I got it done. So anyway, I think that helped quite a bit. What do you guys think about that? Yeah, all right.
No, I think it's great. And the technique of switching back and forth between receivers, when you're a home brewer, if you have a commercial rig, it's really revealing. Because in my case, I think that some of my home brew rigs sound better than my commercial Kenwood rig. The sound is fuller. It has a less filtered feel to it. I don't want to use the word presence, but it has some of that. You know,
It's a presence. It has presence. It's for real.
so I
Good
find
stuff.
like I like and you know, there's probably some confirmation bias in there because I built the one and I didn't build the other, but I like the way it sounds.
And it also gives you the opportunity to make improvements because this is one of the things that's great about home brewing. I mean, if you built the thing and you say, wait a second, I wonder what it'll sound like if I put additional 10 dB of gain in the RF amplifier. Boom, do it. You
Yeah, or
could.
the how come I can't hear that signal, but I can hear it on the Kenwood? Damn
Right. Right.
it.
There's something that's not quite right in here. Maybe I was wrong in imposing a 10 pole crystal filter on this rig, which it adds a whole lot to loss between one end of the crystal filter to the other. Maybe it wasn't all that necessary, but there it is. I'm not going to change that. But I could just add 10 dB to the RF amplifier at the front end.
You had a design goal, which was, you know, cliff skirts. You wanted
I
them
want
dead vertical.
steep skirts that were as close to the SDR as possible. But anyway,
That's another argument for building in modules.
Yeah,
So
it is.
you say, hey, I want to just change this part of a circuit versus the whole big circuit board, one circuit board.
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, I said to myself, I know that the problem is only on the receive side of the TIA. And I had used boards from Scott's K7TFC from mostly RF design. And he allows you to separate them out. And I have a separate board on the receive side, and right next to it is a board for the transmit side. I did not want to add 10 dB of gain on the transmit side. I only wanted to add it on the
There you
receive
go.
side. So I pulled out the board and I just changed those three resistors, put the board back in, and Bob was my uncle. There you go. So anyway, there's still room for improvement on some of these rigs. I don't think there's much room for improvement on the original MythBuster. But on the 17-meter rig and on the 15-meter rig, maybe some more room for improvement. So we'll, as band conditions deteriorate, maybe it'll be time. There'll be time away from operating for me to work on some of this stuff. Hey, one thing I wanted to mention, I have it on my list of things to talk about, is a while back a book came out called Open Circuits, and it was a picture book. It was sort of a kind of a coffee table book for ham radio or electronic nerds, you know? And what they had done is they had sliced open a whole lot of the components, a lot of the components that you see in Pete's picture there, a lot of the components that we use, and took a look at the inside of these components. And I was watching a video from a guy that we watch quite a bit, Curious Mark, and he mentioned that Eric, who is one of his kind of sidekicks there in the Curious Mark laboratory, a younger fellow named Eric. He mentioned that Eric is a ham, and this kind of caught my attention. Or he mentioned that Eric had a YouTube handle, and one thing led to another, and I discovered that Eric from Curious Mark is the author of the book Open Circuits. He's the guy who chopped all the components in half and took a look at them. And he's got a call sign and he's a ham radio operator. So a connection there with another connection with Curious Mark himself is a ham. So there's a lot of connections with the Curious Mark effort and ham radio. So I like that. Hey, blasphemy. I've got to mention some blasphemy. I redrew the schematic diagram for the Michigan Mighty Might. I did it. I did it. Peter, what do you think? Is this blasphemy or not?
No.
I always had found the schematic itself kind of confusing, especially one point where in the I think in the base circuit they have two resistors crossing each other, but they haven't got the dot there. And I think a lot of guys just went ahead and assumed that there was a connection there, and they made the connection, and the thing wouldn't work. Whereas if you re redraw it, if you redraw it in a certain way, you could make it clear that there is no connection, that the base goes to through a resistor to ground, and then on the collector side, there's a connection to ground also. But I redrew it and I posted it. And so anyway, I have redrawn the schematic for the Michigan Mighty Mite. The rig, by the way, that got Dean his start in home brewing.
It did indeed.
And
It
it led to
did.
my kind of defrauding the U.S. Postal Service by sending the crystal through the mails to Great Falls, Virginia.
My wife reminds me of that all the time. She had to go pick up the postage. She said, "What is this postage due package?"
She thought, and she was hoping that it was some knitting supplies, but no,
and then trying to explain to her what a color burst crystal is. So,
and why it's important. All right,
yeah.
this gets me to something that Pete was talking about before, which is tube type transmitters, and it revolves around a tube called the 69, a compactron. It's got in it. It doesn't really. Okay, it's got a triode and a pentode inside one glass envelope. Big deal. The 6U8 has the same kind of thing. The 6EA8 has the same kind of thing. But the 6T9 is a little bit bigger, and it produced a whole range of kind of simple AM and CW, mostly CW, but a couple AM transmitters using 6T9 tubes. And so I have it sitting here. It's over on the shelf over there right now. Maybe I should bring it here, but I probably, well, maybe, okay, I will. Hold on. Look here. I got it in the box, the General Electric electronic tube, and it's the 69. There it is. Look at the price on that thing.
Buck
Buck
50.
50. This is I've had this probably since probably from 1973. I should have built the transmitter back then, but let me take it out here. Listen, I even found a socket. Look, this is what it looks like. This is the 69 compactron tube. It's got in it a triode and a pentode. So if you wanted to, what a lot of novices did back in the day was that they used the triode to build the oscillator. And then they use the pentode to build the amplifier. And then anyway, I put it back in the box and I'm trying to keep it far away from me because I don't want to build this rig, Pete. I'm sorry, I don't. I know I should, and the tube is kind of calling me to do it, but I am fighting the temptation. What do you think,
Why?
guys?
Why are you fighting the temptation? Why?
Because, well, one of the main reasons is I no longer like to mess around with high voltage. All right.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is I have a bunch of rigs that'll produce the similar amount of RF using transistors.
Okay.
I have a tuna-tin too. I have a crystal control tuna-tin too that I could put next to the direct conversion receiver and make contacts with. I've made a lot of contacts with it. And I have a DX40, which you guys can see. Look up there. There's a DX40 right up there. I'm pointing to it. There's a DX40 with a VFO right next to it, right? I could use that. Over behind me on the other side, I have a DX100 if I wanted to. I know what you're saying, Pete. I should do this because I am a radio amateur and I should build something, right? Frank Jones would want me to build it. Anyway, I'm fighting the temptation. Dean, what do you think?
Your $1.50 tube is going for $20 on eBay right now. I think you should make a profit.
I can't do it.
Think of that, $1.50 you paid for that at $20 now. $20 you
I offered it to Grayson just to get it out of here
for free.
for free. I'll postage paid, man. I haven't heard from him. No, I think he too is avoiding the temptation, the siren call of the 16. They even call these rigs, they call them T-niners. How cool is that?
So I just did a quick search, and the first thing that came up was a DIY audio amplifier. So maybe we could do this as the replacement audio amp for the Solder Smoke Challenge for those guys that just can't stand our audio amplifier.
I think 300 volts on the plate would produce a large body count.
It would improve the quality of the chat on Discord.
Right. One thing else I wanted to mention here before we get to the mailbag, because the mailbag, we got a good mailbag this week, but I keep getting messages from Google explaining why Google refuses to put ads on the site. And it just shows you what nerds they really are. They keep sending me a message saying, "You're almost ready to put ads on your site. You just need to correct one small problem, and that is what they call low value content." Low value content in 10,000 blog posts. So how am I going to go back and fix the low value content in 10,000 blog posts? No, I'm not going to do it. But it's interesting. I turned to Gemini and I said, "Explain to me why Google, which runs Gemini, by the way, is telling me that they can't put ads on my site because of low value content." Gemini came back with a remarkably honest answer. And they said that it's those stupid bots that Google's using. Their bot just looks at, and it sounded to me like bots talking bad about other bots. They were botting, trash talking the other bots. They were saying the Gemini, the Google bot looks at your site, sees 10,000 blog posts, and just assumes that it's AI slop, that it's just some automatic machine that churns out a whole lot of content, and that they're attempting to make a little bit of money by having lots of people visit this. They can't see the difference between 10,000 blog posts produced since 2006 and an AI slop. So because of that, they keep branding me as low value content. They just assume that I'm AI slop. What do you think? What do you guys think?
That's terrible.
I know. There's nothing you can do about it either, because you try to call them and talk to somebody on the phone. No.
And if you used AI to rewrite it so it's high value, then they'd know you were AI slop. So,
You're kind of doomed. I was only making like $6 a month anyway on the ad, so we could probably live without them
So, Bill,
anyway.
I got one more quick update before mailbag.
Tell
And
me, tell me.
so for the guys in our Discord channel, we have been spammed and botted over the last 24 hours, and it was filled with Bitcoin posts and all this kind of thing. So as your erstwhile moderator of the site, I have installed some security. So if you go to it, it may ask you to reconfirm who you are. I don't know. I just turned the thing on. Anybody new coming in is gonna hit the general channel, and they're gonna have to acknowledge the rules before they can get to the next page. And the rules are things like be nice, and don't piss off Bill, and a few little rules like that, and then you click OK, and it'll
Don't
let you
talk,
know.
don't talk, don't say that the only way to make a VFO is with an SI-5351.
So anyway, I did that this morning. I spent about an hour cleaning out all the junk from the bots and the spammers, and hopefully that will clear up the Discord channel.
Hey,
Thank you.
Bill, I wanted to mention you're a brave guy willing to take comments on your blog. And the reason I say that is I was taking comments for a while, and somehow there's like 1,000 women that were posting on there offering their services to me. I said, whoa, no more comments. So this guy wrote me, he says, how come you don't take comments? I said, because, he says, oh, okay, I understand. But I mean,
So,
do you get anything like that? I mean,
Pete, you've been advertising yourself as a chick magnet as long as I've known you.
yeah.
The beret, man, the beret. You shouldn't be surprised, Pete. This thing happens. It's like the people write to me, they say, back in the day when I was putting ads on the Solder Smokes blog, people would write back to me and say, I am really outraged that your blog is carrying these pictures of scantily clad young women. I think this is outrageous. And I would have to just gently remind them. I said, I have no control over what ads appear when you go to my site.
Yeah.
Google is looking at you.
Yeah.
Hint, hint, hint. Anyway, those days are behind us because ads are over. Anyway, thanks for doing that, Dean. Thank you. Hey, Solder Smoke mailbag. Bong. All right, we got some good mail this week. We got a very nice email from Wes, W7ZOI. And he's doing well, and he comments on a lot of important and nice stuff, so it was really good. We mentioned Peter Marks, VK3TPM. He managed to fix the index file with the help from Claude. And Peter really he makes really good use of AI, because I said to him, we had a lot of trouble with the index file, mostly created by me because I wiped out the index file. And it's a long story. But anyway, the index file was super messed up. And I turned to Peter. I said, Peter, help me. Can you fix this? And he looked at it and he said his heart sank because there was all kinds of files in there that created all kinds of bloat that made it bigger than it seemed to be. And it was like 35 megabytes. It was big. It should be in the kilobyte range. It was really out of control. And so Peter, at one point, thought about it. He said, man, it's going to be like a lot of work going back, fixing up each one of the 200. What number are we on, Pete? What's the number?
265.
All 265 entries. But Claude could do it like that. So he told Claude to fix it up. Claude did it. Boom, boom. And we posted it. So thanks to Peter Marks and thanks to Claude for fixing up the index file.
Yeah, I had worked with you on that about a year ago, and I came to the conclusion that I wasn't going to do that much work. But that was before Claude got good at that kind
It's
of stuff.
amazing because you even suggested, I remember you suggested that we seek out some human being who'd be willing to do this work, and I couldn't find anybody, right? But then Claude came along in the interim, and Claude will do it. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so thanks to Claude and thanks to Peter Marks. We're also with Peter and Paul, VK3HN, two guys from the Melbourne area. We've been talking a lot about AI. Also with Dean and Bob, KD4EBM, who's also the Vienna Wireless Club. The four of us have been talking about AI, and it's been really interesting. So thanks to everybody in that group. VK3HN, I mentioned, he had sent us the Fine Business AI QSL, originally from ZL2BNE. I have that up on the blog. BNE was a really it's a he's a very very fine business home brewer, and a QRP-er. And he was interviewed on the Red Summit ID by Charlie not long ago. I didn't see that. I had asked people after I posted my blog. My QSL card, my AI produced QSL card. I'd ask other people to send me copies of the things that they had produced. And Bruce, KK0S, who's been a longtime participant in the Solder Smoke podcast and blog, he sent two of his Fine Business AI produced QSL cards. His are much more photographic, mine are much more drawing style, but his really look good. Roger, Papa Alpha One Zulu Zulu, our good friend. He has been sending us a lot of stuff from about AI, and it's from the world of L, and it's the world of L AI. I don't know. I don't know. I look at this thing a lot of times, and my answer to the whole thing is I don't know. For example, she claimed at one point what her hometown was. She said her hometown was the Vatican, and her first language was Latin. Nope, I lived down there. Nope, that's not true. So anyway, we're still trying to find out about the world of L. Oh, the Michigan Mighty Mite. Ryan, KJ7KVD, is going to build one. I sent him some parts. And I also sent him the blasphemous redraw of the schematic. So we're waiting to hear from Ryan. I hope he builds the Michigan Mighty Mite. He's the guy who started listening to the podcast like a year or so ago, but he started from the very beginning. So he's only up to the point where we're talking about the Michigan Mighty Mite, something like 212 or something like that, a long time ago. Anyway, good
So
to hear from you.
Ryan, I have been in your shoes. Beware, there are dangerous waters ahead.
You might become a truly addicted home brewer. You might have to retire, Ryan. All right. Robert, W8MOX. He's here from the Annandale, Virginia area. He might be a member of the club, but he heard my 3-watt beacon from the Dominican Republic. I have a little beacon, produces a beacon signal using a circuit from Doug DeMaul called the Little Slugger and a keyer that had been produced for me by Mike, WN2A. He sent it to me. And I just connected the keyer to the transmitter and connected the whole thing to a little vertical antenna, and boom, it started pumping out 3 watts with a beacon signal, CW beacon signal on 10 meters. And it
So
was picked up.
the keyer is a little software, a little microcontroller with
Yeah,
your call sign in it.
a little pick. It's got the call sign. It's got the, please send a report to, and in tones at different level, at one level. It's really neat. But you have to kind of pick your battles. You have to know what you're good at. I knew I wasn't good at that stuff, but Mike came to my rescue. So thank you to Mike, and thank you to Robert W8MOX who heard the beacon, and he sent me a nice QSL card, just like in the old days when we used to hear Voice of America or Radio Moscow. We'd send him a QSL card. Pete and I got a really nice email from Kirk NT0Z about the future of ham radio and what went wrong. And there's a lot of kind of descriptions of things that have gone wrong with ham radio. And I think that Kirk was right on target there. It was kind of sad. We got an email from Paul, KL7FLR. Dean, you might remember Paul because he's the one who sent us this spiky looking device,
Toroid winder.
the toroid winder, that you'd put the toroid in there, and then you'd be a little slot that you could wind it and everything else. We gave one of it away. We called it the Toroid King or something to one of the groups in Vienna, in Thomas Jefferson High School, that was producing this. I think they were confused by it, but Paul said, Paul, we dubbed him the Wizard of Wasilla because he is from Wasilla, Alaska. He's the Wizard of Wasilla, and he said he finally 3D printed one of the toroid winders. So using the new technology, congratulations on doing that, Paul. Charlie NJ7V is doing great work on the Red Summit RF program. He's also on the Discord channel. It's great to have him on board. Hey, listen, you guys get a kick out of this. I laugh because I get occasional spam messages asking me, first of all, a lot of them ask, would I like to have their company take over the Solder Smoke blog and podcast and beef it up and make it better, make it more palatable? And I usually write back, I said, look, we have no budget and we have no money. If you're willing to work with us, please let me know. And that I don't hear anything from at all, which is understandable. But I got this one. It said it was from a website called Pod Status, and it reported that we are number two, the number two podcast in the world in Ghana. So we're number two in Ghana, guys. Congratulations.
Wow.
What does it take to be number one?
I don't know.
Do they
Pray
have
for
any
us.
hams in Ghana?
Are
I
there
don't
any
know.
hams
There
in
may be
Ghana?
a couple of home brewers there.
Yeah.
We're number two in Ghana. Hooray for us. So there's hope.
Next time you get one of these queries, tell them you will split the revenue that they're going to generate from Google 50-50 with them, and just say, you take it on, you know, you're the sweat equity here, you work for it, you're going to get paid on the back end, and then see how confident they are.
That $3 a month is really gonna really
But you don't tell them that part, Bill. I got you gotta figure it, you know.
We also heard indirectly from our good friend Farhan, VU2ESE, and there was a real controversy. This was one of those things that just sends shivers down the spine of home brewers. People were complaining bitterly about how CW was produced in the new transceiver, the
Lark,
Larkset.
Lark set, yeah.
And they were just dissatisfied with it, and it was, you know, it seemed to be a mess. Farhan got together with Hans, and Hans was the one who sort of came up with the solution. And they came up with a solution that you just changed a couple connections, a couple of parts in there, and CW was returned back to normal with the price with the proper offset, and you could use CW with the Lark set. Is that about right, Dean?
It is. And, you know, Farhan admits that he does not build his rigs with CW as his primary goal. He even said in the presentation, he put it in because he knew that if he didn't have CW in there, people were going to complain.
And they did. Yeah, I think he was really shooting for the voice POTA operations, which
Well, he wasn't even really intending to speak at 4 Days in May this year, and he got kind of co-opted into it at the last minute. The presentation was actually produced with him with significant help from AI, and so this was not his finest moment in the radio universe. But you know, he recovered from it, and he eventually figured out, yeah, they're right, we got to fix this thing, and he posted the fix.
Fine. It was great to hear from Farhan. We also heard from our friend Walter, KA4KXX, and Walter had a proposal, and that he wanted to try to add a homebrew category for the POTA operations. In other words, if you did something, you'd be able to claim and get extra points, I guess, that your POTA operation was homebrew. I don't know. It seems to me that there's a long way to go there, and I don't know. I don't know. It was an interesting idea. Thanks for sharing that with us, Walter. But I don't know whether it's going to happen or not.
I can see it now. You put an H on the end of it and you'd be OTA.
Botah! And you get 5 extra points. I don't know. Whatever. We heard from Grayson, KJ7UM. And Pete mentioned this, that mentioned Helgi's Norwegian Paraset. That was really cool. Grayson sent us a nice note that he really liked that. Good to hear from him. Gerald, VA2GJ, he sent us some nice feedback on his build of the direct conversion receiver that he picked up. I had some questions about his build, and he resolved them really, really, really nicely. But he also indicated that he's the one who's developing the study material for the Canadian ham radio licenses. And he is going to include the direct conversion receiver in that
Oh,
material
wow.
in the next edition. So that was really, really welcome news.
I think they actually have to build something like that as part of their license, the advanced license in Canada still. So,
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That's even better. It might result in more direct conversion receivers. We're up to 135 now. 135. How many did you think we were going to build in the beginning, Dean?
Less than a dozen.
And we're at 135. And we're still going. We're still going. We're still.
And we are still going. We get a new one. The direct conversion receiver part of the site has slowed down considerably. But we get one or two new starts every week or two. Charlie Red Summit has got a whole bunch of other small projects on there, SWR meters and things like that that people are picking up on. So I've been really pleased that you know someone else is picking up the mantle on some beginner projects.
Speaking of spy radios, because we had mentioned Helge's Norwegian Paraset, a more modern rig were the spy radios known as RT6 and RR6. Obviously, one was a transmitter, another was a receiver. And these were apparently American built, American made. And a lot of them were stashed in countries of Western Europe and Eastern Europe as what was known in as the stay behind rigs, that you would, in the event of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe, groups would be able to go back, dig up these radios, find them and use them. They were two really interesting little rigs, and I found a YouTube video about the RT-6 and the RR-6. And there's a lot of history pages written about them also. But it reminded me that somebody from our radio club has them, and he actually has them. I won't go into how he got them or why he got them, but he has them. And he confirmed that they were in fact the RR6 and the RT6. So there's some interesting, they're two type transmitters too. They use little tubes. I think a lot of little acorn tubes in there too.
Recovered from a far off place with still in the Cosmoline.
And they work great the first time out. They even have a little CW key that you pull out. They a lot of these were used by B-47 bomber crews, and the idea was after you dropped your nuclear weapons on Moscow, you didn't have enough fuel to make it back, so you would start the way back, and by the time you ran out of fuel, you would jump out of the airplane and call for help on CW with the R6 and RT6. And Pete's looking incredulous. I had the same reaction. My thought was, good luck with that,
Yeah.
buddy. All right. We heard from Scott, K6AUS. Scott is the guy who needs the Drake 2B. And he did an update on how many Drake 2Bs were produced in the whole run by the Drake company. And they used a statistical analysis, a piece of statistical analysis mathematics based on an effort that we made during World War II to estimate how many German tanks had been produced. And they discovered that by applying certain formulas to the serial numbers from captured German tanks, you could get a really good estimate of how many were total production. What was the total production run? So for the Drake 2B, the estimate that they came up with was 11,300. And they've got a pretty high level of confidence that that is the number of Drake 2Bs produced. But my thing about Scott is K6AUS Scott, he deserves to have a Drake 2B. And there's 11,300 of these things out there, and some of them have to be kind of ready to be shipped to Scott. And somebody should send one to Scott. And I know that there are a number of them on eBay for $250 or something like that. Those are not really the ones we're interested in. We're interested in the one where somebody's looking at it and think, damn, I want to get rid of that thing. The shack is already too cluttered. I got to get rid of this Drake 2B and send it to Scott. So let us know if you have one rig in this category, and we'll make sure that it gets to Scott, because he definitely deserves it. And it's just wrong that a guy like Scott doesn't have a Drake 2B after he spent so many years. We started talking about how many Drake 2Bs there are in 2008, I think it was, when we first came back. No, it was 2011. We had just come back. We came back in 2010 when we were just here. So 2011, we started talking about this. And he just recently sent me an update based on some additional serial numbers that came in, confirmed that it was about 11,300. So,
Now, Bill, I want to tie this back to kind of part of the earlier discussion with an email about what's wrong with ham radio and why it's dying. And these things come up over and over again. The ICOM 7300 was released in 2016. By 2024, they had sold 100,000 IC 7300s. So I don't know why we keep moaning that the hobby is dead. There's lots of hams. Yeah, people are not on the air as much in some of the old modes, but just click on the FT8 any day. It may not be your style, and you'll see there's lots and lots of stuff going on there. And again, 100,000 units of an amateur radio. So.
yeah, it is. But I think that the ICOM 7300, frankly, It's almost like it reminds me a lot of
I
this
didn't want
site.
to get into that side of the debate. I'm just pointing out that they've sold 100,000 of these things compared to the 11,000 Drake 2Bs that were manufactured,
I'm
right?
going to
So.
send you something. I think I sent it. I already sent it to Pete. I'm going to send it to you. And it talks about the decline in ham radio. And it talks about POTA, the FT8, the SDR, and the Baofeng rigs all contributing to the decline. Oh, hold on a second. My phone is ringing here. Anyway, we'll have to continue that discussion.
Don't be a gatekeeper, Bill.
I don't want to be gatekeeper, no. Finally, on the last item on the mailbag is that we had a correspondent at FDIM again this year, as we've had for many years. Bob W8SX was out there, and we've already posted on the blog the original Bob's interview with Hans G0UPL. I was amazed. Hans was asked how many of the new QMX rigs that his company produces, how many have they sold? 16,000. 16,000 QMX rigs. That's a lot. I was impressed. What do you think, Pete? Is that a lot?
Big number.
That's a big number. And they're still going strong with that.
Yeah.
So good luck to Hans, and thank you, Bob, for sending that. Guys, we've been rambling on here a while. Let's see. Holy, what time is it? I forget.
About an hour and 20 minutes.
Hour and 20 minutes. That's the end. We've reached the magic moment. 7-3 from Northern Virginia.
Happy 4th of July from the West Coast.
Happy 4th of July to everybody. Dean.
And 73 from Great Great Falls, Virginia.
All right. Hopefully this recorded properly this time.
We won't lose the first 2 minutes,
We'll
right?
find out. 7-3, guys. Thanks a lot.
7-3.
7-3.